Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming to the workshop that we're going to hear today from Jim Bradley, who's the TQFE, that's the Teacher's Qualification for Further Education, Programme Director at the University of Stirling, and he's accompanied by Sean McDonough, who worked for the On Track programme, but now worked for Top Up.
Now and again,
which is a widening access programme in the west of Scotland. And following Jim and Sean, we're going to hear from Sharon Clancy, who is the head of Communities Partnership at the University of Nottingham. Jim and Sean are going to talk for around 5 minutes each, and then the we'll be open up for discussion. So hopefully lots of discussion. I just noticed in the programme when I was reading a little bit about what Jim and Sean intend to talk about, and having made the comment that I wasn't quite sure what community engagement was, I noticed in the programme that there's a quote from Cameron. You can take it, it's not from me. And another one, son name's Margaret Cameron. So welcome everybody, over to Sean and over to Jim.
Thanks very much. Hey, good afternoon. I was just saying to Sean, I'm a fairly regular attendant at the FACE conference. I was saying to Sean, the last time I was there, I wasn't there last year, but I was there the year before, and I only got two at my workshop, so I'm assuming that Sean's the big draw this time, so it's very nice to see you all here. We're all going to talk for 5 minutes, and the best tradition I've had at learning, we hope this will be very interactive. In case it's not interactive, we've got the naughty person's chair in front of you, go and sit on for those that don't ask a question. The idea is to get everybody involved, because I said this is simply going to be a conversation. I'll let Sean introduce himself later on until we'll take over in a couple of minutes. Just to let you know, as Margaret says, I'm a teaching fellow at the University of Stirling. I'm the Programme Director for Teaching Qualification for Further Education, and I'm involved in Teaching Qualification for Adult Education as well. I used to be a senior lecturer in adult education in further education, and I used to be a com ed worker, and I used to work for the WEA, so I feel as though I've kind of been through them all, and I've got an opinion of them all, and if I've pinned you to the wall, I'm happy to give you an opinion on every part of it. So please, and I'll try not to go off at a rant or go off at a tangent when I'm here, and Sean and Margaret will keep me focused. Really, just in the way of setting this up, I'm going to give you a very kind of pointed history of widening access policy in Scotland, policy and strategy, since the late 90s. And it was introduced, I know I'm going through the legislation, but it was introduced in the kind of late 90s, and it culminated in the first report on really widening access and success of it in 2005, which was called the Learning for All Report. And the Learning for All Report, widening access, you can see, had been run through four regional forums, of which I was a member of, and I thought we were doing really good work. We got 2005. Disappointingly, as you can see, we discovered that we hadn't made any significant difference to the lowest 10% of the population as far as access to higher education, in inverted commas, which included FE-based higher education. And what we did was the report highlighted this, and then on the next page spoke about young people. So here we are highlighting the fact that we couldn't get the communities involved. And I thought, honestly, I thought somebody had ripped a page out of the report, because adults just fell off the table right away, and we moved on to more choices, more chances. And we've kind of been there ever since, and we're still there as far as young people are concerned. We have absolutely no policy for adults, for adult learning in Scotland since 2005 and before. And we're in real danger in Scotland now, as far as I'm concerned, of forgetting all about adult learning, inverted commas, altogether, and simply focusing on young people. And I think in that way, we're going to disenfranchise whole sections of communities. And this is recently, and this will line us up hopefully for the rest of it. Learning for All report comes out every couple of years to give us another update on where we are and where we're not. This is the one that took place in March of this year, and this is some of the things that came from it. The importance of preparation and transition, and you'll realise how ironic that is when Sean starts to speak, but the importance of preparation and transition, clear structures for partnership and collaboration to allow relationships between university and college staff. Honestly, this is heavy with irony, as you'll hear in a couple of minutes. The committee that oversees all this work within the Scottish Funding Council is the Access and Inclusion Committee, and this is their these minutes were put out in April 2011. This is from their January meeting. And here's another ironic part of it. In time, it was intended that access would be impeded as part of normal institutional practices and procedures. For those of you, if you're wholly involved in widening access within, especially higher education institutions, I find this is... It doesn't matter. I'll let Sean explain that. We'll give you the I'm not giving you my view on it now. But you can guess by then. Concerns expressed, though, that driving towards mainstream access provision and thus funding provision through the court could result in a squeeze, and care must be taken to ensure that this is borne in mind when considering the methodology of how we do this. And again, I'll just kind of leave that hanging there, but it gives you an idea, hopefully, of where we're going with this. And where we're going with this is the whole notion of how we run adult learning and widening access in particular within Scotland. So that's just to set you up, and I'm going to pass you over to Sean. Yes, absolutely.
First of all, Jim's also introduced the background to access and wide participation. That's some things to do with transitions. Before I go on, I'll just introduce myself. Right. Despite the smart attire, I'm actually unemployed at the minute, based on that, because I used to work for this, the On Track programme, the On Track project. I said it's funding cut, which is a real shame, and I know no longer have work for it. Also, a fellow colleague here who used to work for the On Track programme, now is also lost the job as well, so it's affecting more than just me.
Could you just highlight for people what the On Track project?
I've been doing it since January 2009. In a nutshell, the On Track programme basically deals with transition from students in an FE background to HE. So access HNC students, HNB students, all curriculums in college, in West of Scotland College we worked in. We had 17 member colleges, so we had some community colleges, we had Coatbridge College, we had Kilmarnock College, and then the six set of colleges, ones nearby, Yearstow College, Central College, and all that stuff. We focused on getting the, helping them smoothing their transition basically at the university level learning. What that actually meant at a practical level was me, maybe in teams of two or three, delivering classroom based workshops, similar to this, very similar to this. 10 other week periods with it in the timetable, or in study skills classes such as academic writing, right? So critical thinking workshops. This is either with nursing students, with drama students, sociology students from all backgrounds and colleges. The key focus was for us to go in as On Track tutors, get these students who aspire to go to university as independent learners. Right? So it's that old notion that when you're in college, when you're in a college classroom, sometimes you might be spoon-fed as a student, but right. Debatable as it may be, depends on who the teacher is teaching or what sort of student you are. But it's to get them to become an independent learner so as the transition a lot smoother at university level learning. That was the whole crux of the On Track programme. And it was in existence for 10, 12 years. I just joined it in a lot of stages. The exciting times when I was just in a little job, which was nice. Also, it's 2010-2011 session, this last session, where I was heavily involved with the On Track programme, as it sort of grew arms and legs, and it truly came into its widening access and widening participation mould. It not only focused in FE environment, so not only did it deal with HNB students, HNC students, access students. One of the things Jim was talking about, how way and access participation should be focused a lot more on adults or adult returners. We actually took the On Track programme into workplaces, into work-based learning programmes. I myself was personally involved with, many of you are familiar with the Glasgow area, but the Royal Mail Centre, a massive Royal Mail Centre in Springburn in the north of the city. So the size of an airport, it's huge, right, massive workforce there. And with the On Track programme, working with key people like the SDUC, so we worked a lot with the unions, we worked a lot with colleges as well. We were able to send us in there and deliver study skills workshops. So basically, we had men and women in their 40s, and their 50s, and their 60s who aspired to come back into education, were really intimidated about it, felt left behind. And we were getting in there saying, by the way, if somebody asks you to write an essay, it's actually not that hard. This is what it means, this is what it consists of. They would do that through union workshops, and there wasn't much success. They brought in an On Track programme in attendance to this shot right up. I'm not saying that because of me, but it probably was, right? But not only that, right, there was other good shooters as well, right? I wasn't the only good shooter there, right? There was a few, some of them. That tended to work quite well. We've done it in prisons as well. We've done it in Bullinay, so HMP Bullinay, HMP shot, you know, just the middle Scotland basically. Not working with the prisons, but working with the staff, because a lot of the staff in there were too concerned that the prisoners were getting in there, rightfully so, you know, having the right to education. We're coming out of there a lot smarter than the actual staff, so the staff wanted to catch up, you know, and be as smart as the prisoners. So we've done that with the staff there. We've done it with HMRC workers, you know, the customs and the taxmen, basically all the taxmen, the way they decided to teach them as well. So it wasn't just an FEHE link, so that was bread and butter. It wasn't just that. I've done a lot more. And I've done this pilot scheme last summer, so it's been 2000. This time last year, the contract was buzzing. You know, now it's dead, it's in a graveyard now, it's gone. Now, this time last year it was buzzing, it was full of life. We'd done this thing called the Summer Support Study, and this was just the essential transition for students who had just left college and they were going to university. A lot of them were international students as well. English not their first language. So we really, you know, came across a whole spectrum of students. It was basically an informal, non-classroom based summer sort of preparation workshops via email. So I would, as an on-track tutor, I'd physically have the email addresses of 120 students who had previously received on-track whilst in college. And if they felt they wanted more information once they'd left college, you know, before they went to uni, they'd email me. And then for that, I used to meet up with some students and used to take them on tours of the campus. I've done it at Glasgow Uni a couple of times, and it was more often at Caledonian University, which is where the on-track programme was based. So that was just some of the work in the last 2.5-3 years that the on-track programme done. And I think you can appreciate that it kind of grew, you know, just at the time I joined it actually. It kind of grew and it went a lot more out with just focusing on FE levels and FE students. When it was just focusing on learners within colleges, you know, majority of them were young, but there was a lot of obviously adult students and mature students there as well. But when it went into the workplaces, there was an awful lot more. Because we no longer exist now, we also done a lasting legacy, which was a DVD learning tool, which was the next one in the video. Where I'm the star in this video, by the way, so if you remember my name, YouTuber, that was personally requested by colleges because they knew we'd no longer be available after this summer.
The Open University as well,
because we worked closely with them in the workplace learning programme. So it was a highly sought after organisation. It wasn't just, you know, a 2-3-4 year, you know, flash in the pan kind of widening participation programme, which didn't really work. It's been funding for over a decade. It was working well. The latest statistics were that we took in over 2,000 students, I think, in the last session. 19 colleges, 9 different workplaces, including the Scottish Trade Unions Congress, the amalgamation of all the trade unions in Scotland, and a massive intake of students more than the previous years. And yet we get the funding cut, so it dies this year. Why is that? Why is that happening when, you know, we have to encourage and build confidence for all learners and there's a need for preparation and transition? This need's always been there. The on-track programme was always there to provide that, and it done it successfully, as the figures show. It's the constant requests show, and the growth in the company grows, it shows, but yet the funding gets cut. Which leads us really into the key questions, and why we don't know why I speak too long, because we've discussed this, to come to some proper answers. So we've got three or four questions up here. I'm such a good on-track shooter, I can't count. We've got three or four questions up here. Why hasn't widening access worked? Why has it not been sustainable? It works at a ground level when I'm in speaking to a class of people. It helps people in workplaces, people in prisons, people in colleges get to where they want to go. Why is it not sustainable? Why is it constantly changing, constantly the way, you know, funding getting cut? These are issues we'll talk about. We all know that bold decisions need to be made, but how do we make these decisions or influence the decisions being taken? Why are such decisions being made? Using an example of the on-track programme, this is arguably, in fact, not really arguably, the most successful year we ever had in terms of growth, in terms of output, in terms of what we actually managed to change, but yet makes us no more. I'm unemployed because of this, right? If we want to make a significant difference in line of access, there will be casualties. How do we decide what these will be? Is the on-track programme a worldly casualty? Can you think of any more? Can you think of certain things that we can draw for other things to grow? That's the thing we want to discuss, all right? Then what do we do next? Hopefully answer some questions and get a bit of debate. So I think in a nutshell, we try to show you the history of line of access, the state that it is just now, using the example of me, you know, working in the on-track programme. That's a big example.
Thank you very much. And now it's your turn. If you look across the UK, it's littered with on-tracks. It's littered with the projects, the widening access projects that I've been involved in. And it's always been a peripheral activity. And it's been a peripheral activity. I've now been working on widening access for 22 years. It's always been a peripheral activity. Now, I don't have any rails for it. I'm just fed up. I'm fed up doing the same things, and I'm fed up with short-term funding, and I'm fed up with not being mainstream. And so I've decided that as part of my campaign before I retire, that I'm going to now focus on asking myself hard questions. One of the things we had this conversation about at lunchtime, and I was thinking, one of the people who has got to put, you know, has got to take responsibility for us are people like me. You know, I ran short-term projects. I took short-term funding. I've been, I was involved in the Wigan Access Forums. And the money came and you took it because you thought maybe this will do a bit of good. And actually, I'm beginning to question at any time if any of that was a worthwhile way forward. Because I'm beginning to think now that what I did was I raised the expectations, and then as soon as the money disappeared, I just disappeared as well, and it was obviously not always one. So really, this is just, we're going to throw up to you now because we just want a discussion. And actually, it's these two specifically I'd like to focus on. There's going to be casualties in widening access. There always has been. But if we're going to continue, if we're going to mainstream it, if we're going to sustain it, we're going to have to decide where that's going to be. And the next thing, and this is for everyone, and I'm really serious about this because I could do with your guidance here, what do we do next? Because given the current financial climate, it's a peripheral activity, it's the first thing to go. So what do we do? So we'll take comments... questions,
money,
really as well. We would take, but that's
a job.
That's an aside.
A
job. That's an aside. So
I'll get a job.
So we'll as I said, please, we'll take comments and questions. Want to be as interactive as possible. Sorry, Margaret, I'll leave you for the questions.
Do you want me to
yes, please.
I should introduce myself because in my role as senior program coordinator at the West Scotland Wide Access Forum on track funding programs, I'm so it's nice to meet you. I was going to say that first question, actually, sorry to miss out on the last two, Jim, but the first one that hasn't been the access board, there are actually some indications in Glasgow recently in the last year that perhaps some widening access initiatives were actually having an impact. Statistics were showing that the proportion of people from disadvantaged communities and groups were actually starting to make up a higher percentage small gains, but there was some indication of that. So maybe part of the answer is you already said yourself, Jim, that if you want to blame something, I believe in the funding mechanisms. Because of the funding mechanisms, widening access initiatives never been mainstreamed in a way that we would all like to see. And in that sense, they cannot become embedded. There are always these little projects, these little programs that are a little extra add-on, and they're not seen as central to the core work of institutions. And I think that part of that has been really funded. But also the way that we have, I suppose, envisaged what education is about. And coming from a higher education perspective, the idea of universities, for example, being a lead institution for so long, that philosophy is still there to some extent, certainly in some universities, but also in other. That's the problem.
Thanks.
I'm with you, despite the accent, I'm working in England doing missionary work because they need all the help. We are at the University of Cumbria. Obviously, aim higher. And the guy who was in the panel this morning, round table on the Welsh Hill, who said we have not made progress. We have made progress in widening participation. Mark Corver from Hefke has a report, has statistics, and the government loves statistics. the percentage did go up from young people from disadvantaged areas going into HE, young people, first-time entrants, first-year students, but not to the elite universities. That hasn't shifted. That's what this government is now focusing on, fair access to the professions. They want a few very bright, very poor young kids into Oxford and Cambridge, job done. It's the Sutton Trust, it's all of that. But in a way, although Aim Higher is going, potentially, because of these access agreements that we've had to send in to offer the Office of Fair Access, our university and every other one that's charging above 6,000, which is virtually all of them, has to say what they're doing about widening participation. So personally, that's where I think you need to go, because why has it always been like that? It's the way equalities used to be. Everybody had an equalities officer, and that was the person you went to. Oh, equalities, not me, go and see that person. And now most people have accepted, some of it's legislation, that equalities is embedded. It's everybody's business. And we have got it down in the University of Cumbria as one of our core values. Opening doors, transforming lives. So don't you be telling me that's your core value and not say you're going to fund it. So our particular one is using its WP. We have WP premiums that every university in England is still going to get for this 1 year of transition. What are they doing with that money? We might be putting ours into a structure, a job for me maybe, but that's the way to do it, I think. Whether you agree with the fees or not, it's gone. We've lost the battle. We're not going in the streets for them again. You've got to work within the system. And I've said to them, if everybody in our university is committed to this, I'll do the job. If it's down to go and see her, she's the WP person, we're going to get more. It does actually have to be embedded. And I remember the woman from Aston said, if you cut our arms open, it runs through us like rock. And that's what you need to get. Not just a few people paying lip service to finding participation.
Could I just comment, if you don't mind? I like the idea of widening access rock. I think that's a great idea. I'll steal that idea and pretend it's mine. Right. I think one of the things that previously the University of Stirling, I joined from FE, I was the FE continuing and education officer, and my role was in articulation. And trying to get a university to accept articulation, and we're an old University of Stirling, not an ancient university, trying to get them to accept articulation was hellish. And mostly, as much down to, I have to say, senior college management and senior university management as it was down to staff, both in FE and in HE. And I think the idea to say that it's just located, that the problem with FE, HE transition is just located in HE is something that we need to revisit. And I take on board the fact that what Paula said, and Paula not only for our work that she did there, but previously for the research work she did in CRLL, a lot of great work, a lot of great stuff coming out. But in the main, it's a mainstream activity, and that's the point I'm trying to make at widening access. We've made some, and we all have within the room, we'll all have examples of what that's done and it's made a difference, but it's only made a difference on the edges, and that's my kind of point about it. And I understand what you're saying as far as as the fees are concerned. It's not that long ago since we were told it wasn't going to happen with the fees. You know, that the vast majority of them, you know, would much charge £9,000. Slippage, mission slip, you know, the usual jargonised nonsense, but that's my concern with it. You see, it was already a peripheral activity, it's just going further and further ahead.
There's a question.
Yeah, my name is Cheryl Isaac, and I'm with the University of the Fraser Valley, along with my colleague here. We're about an hour out of Vancouver, British Columbia. As a director of continuing education, and I suspect from what I've heard yesterday, it's much like your FE.
Mm-hmm.
Although we are part of the university concept. There are colleagues of mine across the province of British Columbia, their departments have been absolutely decimated, like gotten rid of, their FE departments have been gotten rid of. And yet there's tons of funding out there. So what do I do? You apply for this funding, and what kind of message are we giving to the students for the next year? So across the water, it's happening as well. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer. I know, like you, we have done an incredible good, but
I'm sorry, I really wanted an answer. You know,
I really
it's something
in
the room with an answer.
Yeah.
I
take this question here, and then there's yourself and yourself. If that's okay.
I'd just like to endorse the previous point in terms of where this goes. If you're helping the transition, what the others do not have the skills that enable them to continue and finish their education. So I work for AIM Higher, encouraging other people to continue to develop higher education. We sort of leave them on the doorstep and we don't really see much of them. But as time goes on, you identify that some students don't actually make it, people don't have the underpinning skills. So these types of activities that enable them to make the transition not only helps the individual, but also helps the reputation of the institution. Therefore, they need to look at what the full impact of these initiatives are. So if they need to use some of the, say, that the premiums that the government students pay their fees, do the maths.
Mm-hmm.
Does it equate to something that is worth investing in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What's one?
Carly Hazeldine, Head of One Participation and Outreach at Kew University. And really, I've been involved in writing our offer statement and those sorts of things. And I think why hasn't widening access worked is a really key question. Because as hectic as March, April was in pulling together the offer statement with another ridiculous timescale, it was really positive because it was being embraced and it was being embedded into the institution. This is a change in time, etc., etc. Yet, in the last couple of weeks, we begin to get announcements of, you'll hear in the next couple of weeks as to whether it's been successful. I get the feeling that what we all predicted as practitioners, that in reality this would have no ticks. This is the reality.
Mm.
I have now heard senior management whisperings of, I didn't really question anything. Maybe we were too generous. And we knew they were skimming it on a thinner line with the hope that they might come back and ask for a bit more. And now they're like, well, maybe we're being too generous.
Yeah.
The reason it doesn't work is because nothing is ever followed through. And I would say that you know what we are all doing, I think, does work. I think we have to look at it from a realistic perspective of, actually, we have seen sort of improvements in the take-up of higher education. And in fact, if that stuff hadn't been happening, hadn't been going on in the last couple of years, how bad would the impacts of the recession have been?
Point.
Naturally,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Why is it
yeah,
just
absolutely.
We have to see a percentage increase
yes.
in the numbers
yeah, absolutely.
Going? The fact that we've managed to sustain some sort of engagement in higher education in this current climate is, I think, phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I also think what is going to be really important is that we do learn lessons from everything that is going. It's really, really difficult, and I have exactly the same situation in my team. I was due to lose 6 staff in July as a result of the end of AIM Higher. I've managed to negotiate additional funding from the institution, which means I now only lose 3. But there is still a net loss.
And that's one thing about the funding that we discussed upstairs.
Yeah.
Part of it is, you know, because people work in short-term funding, it is about people's jobs and careers. And
it's about using the expertise as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
the skills that you offer and those sorts of things. If I had a job, I'd give you one, but I'm trying to retain
yeah.
my team. But I do think it's really, you know, one of my biggest concerns has been potentially losing people that have got 6-7 years experience in this field that will just go into the unemployment market. It's absolutely ridiculous to know that in 2-3 years' time we're going to be in crisis again and there'll be a bunch of money coming in again, but we've lost all the experts and starting from the beginning.
Yeah.
So what do we do now? I think those of us in the institutions, we have to make sure, regardless of what offer come back and say, that we hold our institutions to their offer statements, that we use that stick over and over again, and we don't. One of the things that I find it very difficult to do all the time now is not to fall foul of the, well, you know, this figure looks a bit better on paper, so we'll use this one. And we actually, you know, have an internal battle to say sometimes, no, you need to put a bit more money into this, or we haven't met that target, let's be honest about it. And so I think there will be some interesting internal institutional politics back at the ranches as this moves forward, because actually as it becomes embedded, there is also a risk of it being slightly more veiled, shall we say. One of the great things about partnership working across things like AIM Higher was that the numbers were the numbers and you all worked on them together. I think now institutions may be slightly more protective over the numbers. I think we just have to be cautious as leaders of those practices and institutions that we ensure that we're providing accurate evidence and making sure that they're keeping to their offer statements. I think that's where we go.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I have a you've said half of it, but I'd just like to reiterate what Hazel said, and also take that one step back. You've got to take the long view on Wymy Access. You know, a number of us have been doing it since, you know, God knows when. If I go back to my time at university, one in 25 to one in two in English university, so that is an incredible widening of access.
Yep.
So I think, you know, it's worked. The information that we've had in terms of higher is that the percentage of young people from the lowest economic backgrounds are actually, it's a higher percentage of people going into higher education than the middle classes and the middle class. So I think it's worked in terms of, you know, going back to the more disadvantaged people as well.
Yeah, yeah,
so I think it's a kind of working thing about it. I mean, I'm the same as many other people that my job finishing at the end of the year, and my team are all, so that's another thing which is disappearing, which has been doing this kind of work. And I do think, despite what my colleague here says, I can feel, I do think that as the WAMSVH activities are kind of embedded in strategies and in kind of action plans of various sorts through the agreement, access agreements, and through the WUPS and the wide participation system in English universities, there is a mechanism there to make sure that it does work and that it, you know, we've got to find a way to make sure that universities don't just kind of slide through it.
Absolutely.
And that this year it is made as little of a transition of gap as we can. I'm not quite sure if the answer to your question exactly.
Yeah. Can I ask what your last acronym is, Wider Access? What was the last one you said?
WP Strategic Assessment.
Oh, yes.
All right. What did you call it?
Whoopsa.
Whoopsa. Well, I quite like that. I just thought, I heard the whoop thing and I thought, well, that's quite good. I quite like that. Whoopsa. I'm hoping somebody writes a policy like that up here just so we can use that.
Tony Hudson University is like, Jim, I'm afraid I don't have a silver bullet either. And in fact, I'm going to add to your
bullet. Oh, no.
I think it's quite right that colleagues are working on inquiring in the forums in Scotland to have the learners as their focus. But actually, we have colleagues are around the room who are losing jobs in Ohio. And what we are going to lose are those blended professionals, those boundary spanners who can work both as practitioners but also work with academics, bridge the gaps between FE and HE, between schools and university, and that's a really very important skill in doing that translation. I just wonder what our projects are there, both north and south of the border, in terms of maintaining or trying to capitalise on the legacy.
Mm.
Of
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm Australian, so I'm very outside of this discussion, but I've just spent a few weeks going around different universities and asking these questions over here and asking what could have been a safety net for these types of activities, because we want to learn this for Australia before it happens there. And there were two dominant responses came up that you might be interested in. One was the nature of research that was done during the time that the research that was undertaken maybe wasn't meta enough, that it was too evaluative, figures of success and things like that, but not in terms of, I suppose, in terms of conceptual research, and that didn't build a case that people were so busy doing that they didn't build the case of why you couldn't go without it, you know, what the damage would be to go without it. And the second thing that came out was the nature of struggle, and that it, in fact it was possibly that it became too easy to have access to the funding and the activities. And again, it was the busyness of doing. And often, what you're finding there, of course, is the nature of the struggle and the creativity and the innovation and the resistance that comes out of struggle and challenge that people thought they hadn't actually probably been innovative enough as well, because in different parts it seemed too easy. So I don't say that as a stakeholder, I'm just reporting back to you I heard as I went around different places and from visited three universities in England.
I
met the university support staff, and I met the faculty staff, and research support staff. So I went through a broad spectrum of
right, we've also got facing political decisions in government, and despite the evidence for aim higher, for whatever reasons, that the government are being managed to ditch it. And we can't help thinking it's because of the association profoundly with previous governments and the fact they don't like the way aim higher works.
Yeah, it's also kind of disappointing that they're going to lift the cap numbers, but the cap are going to be for the high achieving agency, and that's kind of disappointing. That I think it takes us back a step. One of the things I'm really interested in is someone who works at the university is that whole idea of research and then the quality of research. Paula, have you got a view? I mean, you were there with the Centre for Research and Lifelong Learning. How did you find the whole research agenda as far as widening access is concerned?
Yeah, I think there's a lack of good quality research and access and participation. I think when you look at some of the all you have to do is sort of go to the journals, for example, NIACE's journal on widening access and was asked, for example. And that's one of the few journals that actually focused on widening access. So that was a lost media selection. I think the other thing is that when I look at the literature of widening access, there's not very much of it.
No.
And I think coming back to your point, I think you're right, and a lot of people we spoke to are perhaps right in that there was a lack of conceptualisation in terms of thinking ahead to these very circumstances where funding holds, people lose jobs, more to the point, students are losing out because these opportunities are no longer there. So I think that's probably what I'm saying in relation to this research, and we should learn lessons from that. We should all try and be more active and be vocal through writing, through our institutions, etc. And in terms of what do we do next, I think that's part of the answer, which is we have to be vocal. We have to, for the people who remain in the institutions who haven't lost their jobs, and for the people who work elsewhere in education or whatever, I think it's to keep the message there that this is important work. It shouldn't just be ad hoc work. It shouldn't just be bolt-on work. It should be proactivity. Governments are serious about widening access, then we have to put the money where the roots are, basically. And I think we as practitioners have to be vocal about that.
Thank you very much.
Can I just sum up that I really enjoyed your presentation. It certainly has been food for thought. We all, I think, agree that this should be embedded, but it should be impartial, because when it's left, I think, my view, it's left with individual institutions are going to take the institutional interest, maybe not the learner's interest as well. But there's a concern that there's young people there who have gone through the FE route onto the higher education sector route that don't have the study skills. And when I was working in continuing education in the University of West of Scotland, well, what was the University of Paisley at the time, now the University of West of Scotland, I did look into those students who had come into the university with an HND, a higher national diploma in Scotland, which sits at level 8 in our framework, and that we found that they failed in their progression in the modules that they did in the first semester, because they were not used to the study mechanism, not because they didn't have the competence to be able to study at that level, but they didn't have the skills that university was using. They had been using skills that had been developed within the FE sector and had been successful there. And we developed a programme very similar to On Track, familiar with On Track. It was called The Next Step. And my colleagues after that did some research for the students who came in after that programme had been in place, and looked at the students' progression from that onto the next semesters, and they found that there was actually a better progression rate and less of a failure rate. And so the work I think that you've been doing in On Track, I'm familiar with it, is really important. I think what we've all said here is that we're worried about those people who are progressing, because there is a conflict here. with the Funding Council, because I work, as you know, for the Scottish Credit Qualifications Framework, and one of our challenges is to increase the progression from further education to higher education. And if we know there's at that transition point there's a likely possibility that these people can fail, then we're not doing anybody any favours, to be honest. And so I think that's a bit of a conflict. And also, I totally agree with the loss of staff. It takes a long time to build up the networks and the relationships in place. So thank you very much, and round of applause. Could I introduce Sharon Clancy from the University of Nottingham? And Sharon is the head of Communities Partnership, and she's going to be looking at universities as agent of change in the context of the big society. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Just want to give me a little bit of background about where I'm coming from in terms of this paper. I'm going to try and whip through my slides because I think I've over-prepared and that there are way too many. So if anyone's really interested in my paper, you're more than happy to have copies afterwards. I am, as just been said, I'm head of community partnerships at the University of Nottingham. This makes me a bit different in that I sit within the Widening Participation Office, but we don't have much connection. So I think it's clear that there is a role, in my opinion, very passionately, for community engagement as a method for universities to, if you like, exemplify and live out their social responsibility agenda. But often some of the issues around adult learners are not looked at. Some of the issues around engagement with the third sector, which is where I'm from, are not looked at. And so the social justice agenda gets kind of dumped in my direction, and then it becomes highly politicised. So just so you know where I'm coming from right from the start. This paper was written as my dissertation. I've just finished my MA thesis. And so basically it's kind of fairly heavy duty. There's quite a lot to it, and I'm not proposing by any means to go through it all today. But what I wanted to look at was what the university's role in terms of social responsibility, the social justice agenda, should be, could be, and is, putting it bluntly, in terms of what are we doing really in terms of transmitting understandings of citizenship, what is the role for community engagement given my role within the university, is it a real role now that people are starting to perceive community engagement in a broader sense. Paul Manners is speaking tomorrow, who a lot of you will know from the National Coordinating Centre for Public Engagement. People like Paul, myself and others have been arguing for some time that there's a very narrow understanding of community engagement. It used to just be seen in my university as doing a bit of volunteering. And that generally, without being disrespectful, involved doing team challenges, i.e. getting staff to go out and work in kind of schools, primary schools preferably, and doing a bit of tree planting in local communities. Now, if you're anything like me, and I'm from North Knotts in Mansfield, in fact, that doesn't constitute community engagement or community development in any shape or form, nor my understanding of volunteering. So I came in with a fairly political agenda, I think, from the start. So I was really delighted when I came across people like Stuart Lang, who's the Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of Brighton, who's argued passionately that university engagement with the community has to be radical. It has to be about knowledge. It has to be about its development, its discovery, its preservation, its conservation, its transmission, and its application. And I thought that was a fantastic quote. When I first came to the University of Nottingham, end of 2007, beginning of 2008, I was incredibly grateful to having gone to a conference where I heard Stuart speak, because I suddenly realised that there was a role for people like me within the university sector who are interested in real community engagement. So it's not just, and this is obviously my opinion, but this is what Stuart Lang was saying himself, about spreading civilised values. It's not about the university going out and doing unto local communities. It isn't solely either, though there is a place for this, about economic regeneration or the student experience, though again we have an important role and contribution towards that. What it should be about, he argued, is social, what we call social urgencies, i.e. the place where we start to talk about that nexus between community and university, the real issues of the day that are affecting us all, and we're all living that at the moment quite clearly. So again, without going into this too much, it excited me to think about the historical university community engagement sort of activities and start to look at them, given the chance I had to in writing my thesis to do that, and to see where some of these ideas about a public space where people could talk, debate, dissent, and whether there was any commonality really between the academy, the university, and the public sphere that Jürgen Habermas, a German social theorist, talked about as a kind of place for discussion and debate. There were a number of Victorian pioneers who unambiguously believed that the university sector had a role in social responsibility and public good. They were the ones who, you may have come across the university settlement movement, bodies like Toynbee Hall, were very passionate about getting students from Oxford and Cambridge, it tended to be at the time, to come and live in Whitechapel, East London, which was a deeply, desperately impoverished area at the time, and working with the community in what they described as the friendship method. We could argue till the cows come home whether that was actually a sensible approach or indeed a useful approach, but what it did generate was real community engagement, in the sense that there was a passion for developing night classes, courses, debt advice, in other words, trying to really get into understanding the community, not just doing onto, but doing with. And I'm not an apologist for the university settlement movement, by the way, I just think this is really interesting. And it did spawn, in fact, a number of really important third sector bodies like the WEA, Citizens Advice Bureau, and bodies that I've first in my sort of life outside academia been involved in. So what were probably one of the problems with the university settlement movement, or the biggest problems, were that he'd left, in that he felt that there was a danger in the voluntary sector trying to take on the role that the state should be filling in effect, and trying to deal with issues of social conscience by really telling other people how to deal with their own children. So there's kinds of issues there about the kind of model of philanthropy, etc. In the 50s and 60s, you got the kind of big student movement around community development and community action, and something called student community action sort of movement, which started around that time. It started to become quite a radicalised space, the whole student community action. It was much more part student union than than the university structure, if you like, quite distinctly. And by the late 60s, you've got some very, very strong worldwide student political action. I'm probably telling people a lot of what you know already. And it was seen as very distinct from do-gooding and or social service, which arguably the university settlement movement perhaps could be described as. There was a danger later, however, once you get into the 80s, of starting to lapse back into what I call service-type activities, what we often call volunteering-type activities similarly, which ends up being quite depoliticised and ends up being people working on their own values, really, about what communities might need, and that's the danger. So, as I said, shift to volunteering, not community action. Obviously, I'm arguing that this is a source of it actually becoming depoliticised to some extent. But a lot of the students who come through now have been through a very flawed citizenship model in schools, where they've been taught very little, really, about what citizenship really means as a citizen of civil society. It's really quite heavily prescribed, the citizenship material in schools. It's not really a place for debate. So it's been variably successful so far. So I started to think, well, okay, if it's not working through volunteering and it isn't working through what we might call aspects of community engagement, social service, civil service, whatever you want to call it, is there a place for teaching itself to encourage us to develop social citizens, or what Monica McLean at University of Nottingham calls a critical citizen? And is there a route, should we be looking at some of the US models around service learning, with the emphasis on learning? And I started to feel that even this in some ways ends up becoming about the service rather than the learning experience, in my opinion, again based on quite a lot of reading. And it's still quite individual focused. It's not about people working collectively for change. So I still ended up feeling that it was not really challenging the status quo. Again, I told you this was a Gallup, so I'm apologising now. But obviously I've started to think about some of the more radical thinkers in teaching and in research, like Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator. And he said education by its nature is political, inherently political, and that education has to be about dialogue, debate and co-investigation. And what he meant by that was you work with the communities, you do not do unto them. And research and learning come together in that community, university space, or nexus, as I was saying earlier. So there are examples where research has been used to tackle real social and moral urgencies. Participatory action research, it's been used extensively in Africa, for instance, looking at farming issues. I'm not saying it's not without its problems. Most structures and systems are. However, it's explicitly about bringing communities, in this instance, African community individuals, together as part of the research team and framework. So it's not presuming to know their worlds or to impose a system or structure on them. Similarly, the community studies methodology, which people may or may not have heard of, a famous report from about 1973 at the University of Nottingham, not just because I'm there, it is one I actually had heard of before, interestingly, which focuses on an area called St Anne's in Nottingham, which is still massively disadvantaged, though it was raised to the ground in the late 60s, as it was formerly. And it really was about actually looking at that area ethnographically, not making value judgments, not really commenting on the area, which kind of leaves you to think, well, what was the end product, which is one of the issues, I guess, with community studies. But it was really about understanding that community, talking to people within that community, and again, not trying to impose a particular system of values on it. Same in America, big projects around Muncie in Indiana, a project called Middletown, that was its sort of fictional name. And this whole idea of the researchers themselves, though, influencing how the research takes place, because no, even whether you're a learner, whether you're a researcher, you have a set of values and you bring your own values into any piece of research that you undertake, and that's kind of almost accepted in some ways. But could we argue that sometimes research gets pointed where the rich and powerful direct it? Is it just about sort of arms, agriculture, all the things that maybe we in here have got a wealth of materials and issues that should be being researched, and maybe we should be challenging, going back to the comments that were made earlier. What I did see in this, though, in terms of the community studies, the re-study in St Anne's in Nottingham, which I can comment on personally because I've been part of it, has been going back to the community now, 40 years on and so on, has been really about engaging the students in thinking about that community, not doing unto that community or even trying to live within it, as in the kind of university settlement approach, but really trying to think about social change, social justice, and issues of what the challenges of living in St Anne's might be at the moment. So it's about been about co-producing the research, which I think is the really critical bit. You have to, in my opinion at least, work with communities and research with them, not on them. So what's in it for society? You know, does any of this make any difference? I guess if I were on the receiving end of any of these research opportunities, I might be questioning whether or not I individually or as a community was getting out of it, getting anything out of it. And I do wonder, certainly from my experience, whether community engagement gets simply too messy for universities, because it's not neat and parceled up. It's a broad spectrum of activity. And I do wonder, I did increasingly start to wonder as I was writing this dissertation, whether universities should even try to reflect on imbalances in the system, but I felt ultimately that they should. So I really don't think that we can ignore politics in the sense that whatever we do in terms of our engagement at the moment, it's having an impact. We're losing funding to humanities, for instance. We know that the big society is looming large in a lot of people's minds, particularly in those involved in community engagement type activities. So I just want to finish on a couple of points, really, and maybe we can have a chat. That would be really useful. The big society is not new. It has this notion of returning to the little platoons, a phrase I really dislike. But what it actually means, in my understanding of it, is a group of people who come together at community level because they're able to, because they're interested in doing so. And I tend to think that in Cameron's mind, at least, this is a bit of jam in Jerusalem. It's the kind of people that we're safe with, who are not going to perhaps be too challenging in society. And that's perhaps very cynical on my part. But that's the phrase that he keeps returning to. He doesn't talk about campaigning groups. He doesn't talk about the wider third sector. He doesn't talk about the power of the higher education sector to challenge either. It's all about kind of people who are working in terms of goodwill, active citizenship. They're really keen because they're perhaps local philanthropists, etc., etc. That's not what I went into community engagement or the third sector for, I have to say. I think community, therefore, and I'm conscious of the comments that were made this morning about what on earth community engagement actually means, but I think it's because community, in inverted commas, has become a hugely contested area. Everyone's vying for bits of it, and this is why I think it's so politically fraught. I think there's a danger that fairness in the language and rhetoric of this government is replacing the social justice agenda. At least in Tony Blair's third way, the discourse was all about social justice. Whether or not it ever came to anything is another matter. But we're now talking about fairness, and there's a danger with any language around fairness that we start to get back into the deserving and the undeserving, and that is a phrase that has been used relatively recently. And that really concerns me very gravely. I think there is a move away from collectivism and collaboration implicit in little platoons. They're not campaigning or challenging bodies, as I've said already. They're the ones who are perhaps beneath the radar and beaver away in their local area as volunteers, unpaid, another issue. And I think there's a whole move again towards individualism, towards personal enterprise and volunteering at the expense of collective campaigning and collective action. Finally, we can't ignore this, but do we have to be hopeless and despondent about it? I don't know, is my honest answer. In my area, I lost 2 staff last year in terms of community engagement. However, this year I've managed to secure some funding to support students, postgraduate research students, to look at working with social enterprises in the third sector. So maybe there's hope there, I don't know. I guess it's a shifting agenda, and I think we have to be really creative, and I think we all are. And I guess one of the reasons I wanted to come today was because I felt community engagement is an area that is perhaps less explored here, I don't know. And it might be one that we could talk about as a space for some of this change, who knows. Certainly Paul Manners and others have been pushing for a public engagement manifesto. Our VC has recently signed up to it. I don't know whether it will come to anything, but it is a broad concept of public and community engagement. It's about research, it's about learning, it's about organisational infrastructure. It's about looking at HE as a whole. I think there are new demands in terms of research and the excellence framework, research excellence framework, for to look at social and community impact. I think that gives us some opportunity. There's a very public campaign at the moment, for those who are interested, called the Campaign for Public University. Huge number of academics, managers, administrators across the whole HE sector have come together saying, look, we're not happy becoming some marketized, completely consumer orientated entities. We actually want to say that the university still has to be about public good, not just about consumerism. So maybe this is a space where we can start to continue to challenge ideology and maybe even protect the social justice agenda. I don't know, but I wanted to posit that to you today, and that's me, really. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. Has anybody got any comments or questions on Charles' presentation? Is this a space for debate or discussion about engagement?
I hope so.
Yes.
As we teach in the VA community development at the University of Glasgow.
Right.
So I suppose we talked about community engagement as part of, you know, if you see community development as a big circle, community engagement as a smaller circle. Did I see that right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a danger that some of the ideas that are coming through about community engagement are kind of working within this ideological framework, and that community development is the way of stepping out of that and challenging and changing and taking action.
Well, that's interesting, because I tend to see it the other way around, because I come from I used to run a CBS, Council for Voluntary Service, and I guess we used to often argue the toss that community development sometimes was a tool but not a framework for thinking, which is why I was very interested in some comments from a colleague, Jane, earlier on. I thought that was fantastically useful, trying to think about what we mean by community engagement. I guess where I'm coming from, and I didn't get a chance to go into any of the detail of this, there's a whole lot more to it, I guess. The public and community engagement agenda that Paul Manners is going to be talking about tomorrow is much, much broader. It really is a theoretical structure for thinking about all sorts of aspects of community engagement. And what used to be called public engagement, and when I started, say, at university in Nottingham 3.5 years ago, that was very much about academics going out and talking to non-academics about their specialist subject area. I think there's a much, much broader understanding of public and community engagement now, which is why it's really interesting as a possible space.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And just that sort of worry that sometimes it's used, not by you or Paul, but it is often used.
Oh, I know what you mean, yeah.
It's a worry that, you know, there
is a tiny thing, yeah.
Yeah, or there's national, in Scotland, there's national standards for community engagement.
Yeah.
And even if you just unpick some of the language within that, like, then wait a minute.
What does it mean?
Yeah, what?
I mean, I totally understand that. I mean, I've wrestled with what on earth community means for years, you know. How do you define it? It's incredibly difficult. But I suppose, going back to what I was saying earlier on, I think it is about people having the opportunity to come together at least, and I guess that's what I'm saying, whether they have a shared interest or whether they live in a similar area, whatever it might mean. I think it's about a space where people can at least discuss and challenge what's being done to them a lot of the time, effectively.
Conscientization.
And then action. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So,
Peter, comment.
It's actually to do with this about public universities. I thought your presentation was really helpful, by the way.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much for it. The government have said, I think it was yesterday, it's in the white paper or the comments around the white paper, they want vice chancellors to stop thinking of themselves as being in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
So, increasingly, as students become customers of education,
yeah.
Is there not going to be a danger that universities are going to look at this stuff and go, why do we do that? What we're going to want to concentrate on is giving really high quality service to the students who are who are our customers. So I think, have you started to detect any of those signs?
I mean, I lost 2 staff last summer, and I think it's simply because I've tried valiantly to get away from us being seen as an entirely peripheral volunteering team, really, by pushing this whole agenda about public community engagement in a much broader sense. But when you consider that we share an office with widening participation, and then we literally do not connect with that, this is obviously rather sensitive, but we literally don't connect because they deal purely with non-traditional learners from schools, colleges, 16 sort of age group, don't consider primary, which of course I do think is vital, community engagement, which I think is vital, i.e. adults, and adult learning is long gone. You can see that community engagement could be some entirely atomised thing over here. So you have to keep pushing this agenda, this bigger agenda at them. And I think we become a bit of an irritant in some ways, to be honest. Because we are saying, what you're doing is not good enough. We need to.
What you were saying is to try and get your ideas somehow at the core of the thinking.
Exactly.
Otherwise, there's a danger that you will become peripheral.
Yeah, and we've already been there.
Increasingly become peripheral.
Yeah, or being peripheral, become sort of central strategically, and then go back to being peripheral again. Interestingly, the university's now adopted social responsibility as one of its key performance indicators in the university's strategic plan. But we'll see what comes of that.
I'd just like to find it real interesting. Thank you very much indeed. As a man who has a party plan for the day, Mrs. Thatcher passes on, I've never really in the Tories have ever said. And David Cameron's idea of big society fills me the same dread as my daughters used to say, I'd let you meet my boyfriend.
Yeah.
That kind of terror that's there.
Yeah.
But my main problem is the whole citizenship debate. As far as I'm concerned, this citizenship focus that we've got there just now is about building compliant, depoliticised population.
Yeah.
And the idea now that we throw in the odd community engagement idea is scraps from a table. I'm really concerned. And that's why, as I say, things like saying to the VCs, stop looking at yourself as being within the public sector. Fact is that here in Scotland we had a public sector report come out yesterday that never really mentioned universities, so we're witnessing that here as well. And the whole idea that somehow if we just all shut up, everything will be okay because the politicians will look after it. I'm just absolutely terrified for the agenda, certainly of the current UK government.
I suppose that's why I was trying to think, is there a way of claiming or reclaiming community engagement as a place where some of these issues are raised? I know it's artificial in some ways, and it's no substitute for a proper debate at senior management level about these issues, but can we be sufficiently a social conscious and irritant, whatever we need to be, to keep this debate alive?
I have to say, I'm okay with the overthrow of capitalism and Marxist revolution.
Me too.
But then that's my personal
view. Well, there you go. So.
but just that, I think there are some real issues, aren't there, around conceptions around. And I heard, I think it was Willits who continually said that private. But the universities, okay, maybe the management of the universities, seek to be very clearly institutionally autonomous institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we ought to be thinking of some. What's the favourite public institution in the UK? It's the National Health Service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now there are issues about control of GPs, and they're still independent contractors and such like. But maybe we ought to look fundamentally at who actually effectively owns the universities, yeah? Because we've bloody paid for them for 100 years,
yeah?
So, I wouldn't have a problem, the University of Glasgow, being within the Corporation of Glasgow. Now, the management of your universities would run a mile from that, and some of you in this room obviously would as well. But if you want to get them into the communities, if you want them to be public institutions and doing some of the things you've indicated there, then I think you have to look at those sort of governance structures. Okay, and I'll throw that in as a bit
of a
bomb.
What you're suggesting, that they need to be sort of private?
Well, I'm suggesting that they like the old polytechnics were part of the local education authority.
Okay, I'm with you. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, and I see a lot of people nodding around this room and not liking that. Well, perhaps I would, because if you want to achieve, you're not going to achieve any of that stuff, without them being clearly structured within our democratic processes, and that is probably meaning them losing what they love to claim, which is institutional autonomy. Get real.
I
find this disconnect between the university and the local community quite interesting, in what you're saying about you guys and your WPT not connecting very much, because I see that very much as part of my agenda as leading that team at our institution. As a very campus-based university, we are a public facility. People can come up and use the campus and the facility, but the local community do not, because we are still either institution on the tower, just outside of town, that nobody comes to.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge that we are always, and that's one of the key things that we try and promote in the communities. Just come up and use the lakes, come and have a picnic, whatever, to try and get that introduced and get the get the kids up from the local school so they can see it, but try and instill in the families and the parents that you come up here
isn't
that patronising? Well, come up and use the lake. Sorry, you may have used the wrong phrase, and a little bit provocative, but it's a little bit more than just coming along to use the lakes and the sports club. It's actually having a fundamental decision-making role in what that university does for the local community. A democratic input.
That's what I'm getting at.
And that doesn't want
that is what
there
I
isn't
was
a real
at.
Local democratic input into our
university.
What
I didn't get to say, and I think this is the space where what you're saying and kind of what you're saying comes together. There's a whole research opportunity for working with communities, without taking over the time, but where we can bring some of these agendas together. There's a massive resource there. This is really what I keep saying.
I don't disagree with that, and I know we're running out of time, but it's not being patronised by my local community. I'm part of my local community. I live in Stoke on Trent. I'm chair of my local residents' association. We work together in the community on a completely private level. But actually, for most of the families in that area, the whole idea of even engaging with the university, stepping on campus,
to be honest,
is the first hurdle.
This is a spectrum of engagement without. I think that embraces both of what you're saying. It's a spectrum of engagement. You do have to get people over the threshold, but you also need to get together and look at research.
I need to go out the circle as well. We're at the stage where the doors are getting taken away from the
doors.
I'd like to just draw this to a close and give Sharon a big round of applause. Paula clearly said about being vocal, purely based as a community, and we should be using that to be vocal and to pressure for widening participation.